and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, I believe you've had a suggestion for the episode this week.
Yes, we have. Now, the interesting thing about this one is this is the first time I've met face-to-face somebody who listens to the podcast. Now, full disclosure, the gentleman's name is Greg. I'm sure you can assure that's a lovely name.
It's a wonderful name, that one.
Yes, and it was during my day job. So I'm a trainer during the day, and I went to Greg's company, did some training, and happened to mention the history thing, and that's how Greg started listening to the podcast and actually came with a specific request, and how could I say no? And we're going to come into that for a moment. Greg actually works for a British tile company called Redland.
Oh, Redland Tiles. Yeah, because they've got quite a historical link, haven't they, Jim? Because Redland Tiles, correct me if I'm wrong, they started in about 1919, and it was actually started giving jobs to the men coming back from World War One. And then didn't they, after World War Two, have the Redland 49 tile, which I think is the main tile they used to re-roof London when they were rebuilding after the Blitz?
Yes, that Redland. So people listening, that's Redland Tiles for all your tiling needs. Guess what, Greg? Do you think we're sponsored by Redland?
Do you know what? We ought to be getting some money for this, especially after I remembered those facts.
for the record, we are in no way associated with Redland Tiles. But Redland Tiles for all your tiling needs.
And for the record, if you would want an equally bad job done promoting your business, then please do feel free to sponsor the podcast. Jim, what subject are we talking about today?
Yes, so what Greg mentioned, we sort of talked a little bit around it, but he was mentioning how there are a number of civilizations, a number of powerful men who had personal imperial guards.
I've got to stop you here, Jim, because got a slight problem here. We've done a couple of episodes recently where we've gone a little bit into sort of not unreal history, as it were. We talked about the steampunks recently. We talked about lore a little while ago. Now, my problem here is I thought, because you only got to me about this earlier today, normally I have a bit longer to do some research, and so I typed into the internet, Imperial Guards.
Oh, Lord.
Now, when you type in Imperial Guards, the first page of results are all about Star Wars. Now, you're not going to take us down another Star Wars rabbit hole, are you?
Absolutely not. No. Instead, I'm going to, I think we'll probably end up mentioning the two most famous Imperial Guards, which were genuinely called that, although actually the first one sort of was and sort of wasn't. But the personal bodyguard for the early emperors was the Praetorian Guard, the elite soldiers of the Roman Empire designed to guard the emperor himself in theory. And the other ones, which probably people are also aware of, is Napoleon's Imperial Guard, including the Old Guard, the Young Guard, and the Middle Guard, as they're actually split into different groups. The absolute elite creme de la creme of the French army, the veterans who were much feared in the early 19th century. So I think that if we're looking at those two Imperial Guards, which involve no spaceships whatsoever, these are genuinely two interesting topics to talk about, perhaps mashing them together a bit for the purposes of our podcast.
And I think that's probably going to completely fill up the half hour just talking about those two, and I bet we'll touch on them while we ramble about other stuff. But I noticed you said there, Jim, that the Praetorian Guards were in theory supposed to protect the Roman Emperor. Now, you're not going to suggest that occasionally they did something different.
Yeah. So here's the thing. I find it bizarre that the Praetorian Guard, do you know what? I can't give you an exact number, but I know it's at least half a dozen emperors were killed by their own bodyguard. Surely the opposite of what they're there for.
Well, it kind of depends partly on what you look at as their job. Is their job to protect the emperor as a person, or is it to protect the empire and the idea of the emperor, in which case occasionally it may be necessary to the man at the top in order to keep the whole thing going along?
Well, look, certainly with some of the madder emperors, there can be no doubt that there was probably a very good reason to remove them from that space and time. There's a marvelous lesser-known emperor called Ilaga Bargus, and he was a teenage emperor. He was horrific. He would He would allow people to wander around his palace without telling them that in certain rooms he'd put actual lions, living lions in them, and found it hilarious when people were mauled by these lions. He also had fruit that was actually basically alabaster painted to be fruit, so people would crack their teeth on it. He was an absolutely horrific he's almost like the Roman version of the Joker. And eventually this all came to a head, and at one point he's with an angry crowd, and the angry crowd wants him to resign. He says no, and he actually orders the Praetorian guard to not only kill the crowd but also to commit ritual suicide for him. And they killed him instead. So in that situation, I think we have no trouble whatsoever with the Praetorian Guard doing that. And there are instances where there are clearly out of control guys and they're probably doing the right thing. But certainly over the centuries, they seem to be less interested with protecting the emperor and more being a political force. However, this couldn't have been not known by the emperors. And actually, just sort of fast forwarding a little bit, the famous Emperor Constantine, he disbanded the Praetorian Guard and brought in, off the top of my head, I can't remember what they were, but they were specifically non-Roman soldiers, kind of like Germanic mercenaries. And they sort of, for the late Roman era, they became their version of the Praetorian Guard. And even though they weren't Romans, behaved better. I'm not saying they behaved perfectly, but they certainly, their performance of protecting emperors and not starting revolutions was they had a better run than the Praetorian Guard, which begs the question, how did the Praetorian Guard last for centuries?
Well, here's one of the things with any sort of imperial guard. We'll use that term sort of loosely here for a minute. If they are people that are in their jobs for successive generations of ruler or successive rulers, because, yeah, all right, fair enough, if a ruler comes to power and they have their close advisors, their close protectors around them, that's one thing. Those protectors then completely sworn to that particular leader. But take, for example, the presidency of America. When you've got your Secret Service agents and their job is to protect the president, when that president finishes up, I know ex-presidents do have a certain amount of protection as well, but I would imagine that the core Secret Service, those guys whose job it is to protect the president, then presumably move over to the new president. They are protecting a figurehead, a position, as opposed to an individual person. And yeah, if I was going to become emperor, I would want to select my own troops, my own people that I would bring in to be my guards, rather than use a standing institution who, as I say, they're more about the position than they are about the individual.
Yeah, I couldn't have agreed more. And I guess one of the things, one of the issues, is the very early Praetorian Guard, linked with the very early emperors, those men went out on campaign. Their men were loyal to them. Their men, both they, the leader, and the troops, had suffered together, fought together. Whereas someone like Elagabagus, for example, he was simply too young to have ever done anything like that. And you know, the others that were crazy or lazy or decadent. And so therefore, they had no soldiers to choose from. But in some instances, you got into power because the Praetorian Guard had just murdered the man before you, demanded a ransom, you paid it to them, and now you're going to trust them with your safety? They have in no way demonstrated any kind of loyalty whatsoever. Surely it would be better to just get guys off the street to protect you. Would be better than these easily bribed, highly trained elite soldiers.
What we're looking at here then is a specific group of Imperial Guards who have obviously more political power by far than they actually should. They're almost more of a military protective civil service, as it were. They are on their own, they're slightly separate from the emperor, and as you say, they have control over some of the emperors from the first time they get in. Now, let's park those for a moment and move on the difference. So where do we go with, because Napoleon wasn't part of a long-standing series of emperors at all. Napoleon is someone who comes in. How does his different, because he was on campaign a lot.
Well, yeah, so you could argue that you know, the early Praetorian Guard, which, by the way, originally there were sort of like about 1,000 men. I think the very first number was about 500, then it went to 1,000. And at its peak, it was about 10,000 men, which is more than a bodyguard is needed. It's really just the emperor's army close to Rome, or at least close to the emperor. So that kind of worked when you got on campaign. And of course, Napoleon built his own dynasty on his own imperial power off his own back, and his imperial guard were indeed the soldiers who'd been with him through thick and thin. The old guard, the people who might have been with him as early as his campaign in the 1790s in Italy, where in 1 year he managed to capture the whole of Italy, something that hadn't been achieved by, well, basically since the Roman era. Yeah, but by the time of Waterloo, they'd kind of been campaigning for over 20 years with only the occasional stop and start there. And they were actually known as the grumblers. I forget the French word for it, because they were the only people in the army who were allowed to openly disagree with their officers and indeed with Napoleon himself. And he accepted some of their complaints. So, in other words, because they had proved themselves in battle and because Napoleon trusted them, he was happy to listen to their grievances. Whereas you could imagine the comparison to that, someone like the Duke of Wellington certainly wouldn't have tolerated one of the privates in the army going up to him and complain. He referred to his troops famously as a rabble in certain situations and absolutely disgusted with these common folk. So Napoleon, in a way, had more of a common touch than many of his peers, and it was rewarded by these men. I mean, come on, fighting in places like Egypt and Austria and Germany and Russia. These are just huge different areas to have fought and walked, and the story some of these men must have been able to tell. But the interesting thing, and the thing that I started talking with the other Greg about, is the fact that whereas these men may have campaigned with him hard at the beginning of his career, towards the end, it was noticeable how much Napoleon just didn't send them into battle, particularly in Russia. The Battle of Borodino was an incredibly bloody affair. It was probably his biggest victory in Russia. I think it was one of the largest battles of the Napoleonic War. And it wasn't a particularly great victory, but it was a victory nonetheless. He could and should have perhaps sent in the Imperial Guard into that battle, but he didn't. And there were a number of occasions where it's almost like, I don't want to use up my, it's like a kid playing a video game or something. I don't want to use my extra life here. I don't want to use my power up now. and they, and it's like, you're not using your most potent weapon.
Well, from a few weeks ago when we heard about Jem playing with his Warhammer to today, we find out he's also an aficionado of computer games as well. It's good to know you run a full range of children's
interests.
Activities. Children's activities. That's rude, isn't it? I know adults play games these days. So when we come down to it, you think holding back, but if they are an Imperial Guard unit that are designed as a guard, were they not therefore always intended to be defensive, to stay? As soon as you send a guarding unit out to attack, I mean, is that not like, watch me show some knowledge of something outside of history, isn't that like sending all the defenders to the front in a football match?
I don't
know if that happens or not. I've got no idea.
Right, and the last minute of the FA Cup final, the last minute in a knockout game in the World Cup, you're going to send your defenders forward. You might even send your goalie forward. But let's continue that analogy. Then yes, he should have on a number of occasions. And a bit like the Praetorian Guard, we're not talking about 500 men or 1,000 men. At Waterloo, the Imperial Guard was close to 10,000 men. That's going to make a big difference. And I guess spoiler alert, but at the Battle of Waterloo, he did, right at the end of the day, send in the Imperial Guard. He happened to send them into the area of the field where the English had a whole bunch of guys waiting for an attack, and they slaughtered them, the guard. And that was the only time in the whole of Napoleonic history that the Imperial Guard retreated on a battlefield, which sounds impressive. But as I said, when you start looking at it, there were a number of times when they weren't even used. So, of course, they didn't retreat at the Battle of Borodino because they weren't used at the Battle of Borodino. But when the French army saw the Imperial Guard retreating, that's when the Battle of Waterloo was lost. So it was that's how important they were to the French army. And in a way, yeah, okay, they had not quite been ambushed, but there really was no way out of their situation. But if for some reason they'd attacked a different part of the field and pushed through the lines, that might have been the push that that Napoleon needed to have finally sealed victory at Waterloo.
Did you say that the Imperial Guard had 10,000 men for Napoleon at Waterloo?
So, it was in the thousands. I'm slightly pulling figures out of thin air, but yeah, it was thousands of men. We're not talking about like 500 guys standing around Napoleon.
You see, this is the thing, because when we start to talk about Imperial Guards, I do think about guards, you know, as opposed to
bodyguards.
We're talking about a unit of soldiers here. We're not talking about close quarter scale. Like you say, 500 men in a battle of that sort of scale. I can see 500 men being there purely with the intention of, if people make a, you know, if the enemy make a beeline for the emperor, 500 men can surround him. Once you get into the thousands of men, that's not their main purpose anymore. They are just another fighting unit. And I think that's where I'm going astray slightly in my thinking of, oh, we shouldn't use them, you know, are they just a defensive unit? Once you got that many men in the unit, it's no longer just about guarding the emperor.
Yes, absolutely. But of course, you know, the one thing I would say to defend Napoleon is, if in every battle he sent in the Imperial Guard, you're going to lose men, you know. And also, it's like, well, we've been fighting hard for you for 20 years. Do you really have to send us into the meat grinder this time? So I do, you know, it's very human to say, I'm going to protect the guys who've been with me for a long time. And in a way, that shows you a more human side of Napoleon. But when they are your elite veteran troops who are completely loyal to you, it's surprising how often he didn't fall back on them.
Yeah, I mean, you have got that argument, because I think in the Roman army, it was the freshest, greenest recruits were always the one that was shoved in the front line of a battle with your more battle-hardened troops behind, because obviously you don't want to be sending out your hardened troops to face that first onslaught in any battle, because the fact of the matter was, the first onslaught didn't really matter too much how much skill you had at that point in time. If you're in that initial charge, that initial clashing together, people are going to get killed one way or another. So I think there is that argument to be made that, yes, you know, obviously you don't want to just keep sending them in. You are just going to slowly run down the amount of Imperial Guard you've got. Although, that being said, if you've got 10,000 of them, you've probably got a couple to spare. But so they were completely loyal, you think, those 10,000. Do you think he was ever at real risk from them? Because when we're talking about the emperors being killed by the Praetorian Guards, we're not talking about 500, 1,000 men suddenly turning around and killing the emperor, are we? Presumably we're talking about the closest unit, as it were, of that guards.
Yes, and actually there were, I mean, with the back to the Romans, there were certain years where there were like, there's the year of the four emperors and there's the year of the five emperors. That's a big churn, and I'm not saying all of them were killed by the Praetorian Guard, but they were involved in an awful lot of, we're going to depose you now, we're going to kill you now, we're going to whip up the rabble in the streets kind of thing. And it's like, you're actually a political force. This is no longer military. And yes, I'm sure they would have justified it by saying, we're looking for the greater good of Rome, rather than we've been paid more by this other guy, that's why we're making him emperor. But there was an awful lot of little fig leaves in Rome. For example, actually, there was no such thing as the Roman emperor. They were imperator, which does obviously sound similar to emperor, but the term of emperor had been around, you know, in other civilizations for quite a while. But imperator literally translates as basically successful general. And deliberately, someone like Julius Caesar, he would wear the laurels of victory, but he refused to wear a crown. Rome, you know, even throughout the imperial period, none of the emperors deliberately associated themselves with kings, because that would be unthinkable. The Senate still existed during the time of the Roman emperors, even though it had no power whatsoever. And indeed, it was Caligula, of all the things he could have done, perhaps one of the most heinous ones was he started to dress and act like a demigod. And that was just too much for the, oh, fine, kill loads of people, carry out a purge, you know, do kinds of all kinds of crazy stuff, which I'm not going to go into to keep this as a clean rating. All that's fine. But yeah, oh, start dressing up and pretending to be a god. Well, no, that's completely unacceptable now. And you know, it's so the Romans used a lot of excuses to hide the realities of their society. And I guess the Praetorian Guard, in a way, was a version of that. Unlike Napoleon, because his Imperial Guard genuinely were his soldiers, his men, and they were loyal.
So when we look at the Imperial Guard for Napoleon, do you know, was there a group within the Imperial Guard, you know, sort of, what I'm trying to get to is the actual Imperial Guard, the actual ones who were there with Napoleon. Did he have a core group of guard, or was this just 10,000 rotating? And you know, did he have a core group of bodyguards from within that, or were they someone separate? Or,
well, as I said earlier, the guard itself was split into the old, medium, and young guard. And I think it was the medium guard. Again, I'm sort of just plucking this out, guys. Remember off the top of your head. But it was one of the guards, and it wasn't the old guard, who actually remained on the field of Battle of Waterloo, and they were the last action of the battle, where basically they were completely surrounded by the British. The British went over and said to them, you know, please surrender. There's nothing left for you to fight for. Honor has been preserved. And they simply refused. So then the English brought in at pretty much point blank range their cannons and shredded these guys. But, you know, sort of very messy end to all of this, but showing complete loyalty to the cause of Napoleon, even though Napoleon himself had already fled the field of battle.
So let's bring this sort of into modern terms, and presumably sort of the British modern equivalent of the Imperial Guards would be something like the household troops, presumably. They're the ones. But in reality, if you see the Queen out and about, you see the household guards and household cavalry, and totally respect those guys, and they, you know, they really, really do an awful lot. But you'll always see the guy in the black suit with the earpiece somewhere nearby, a slightly more American bodyguard sort of thing. Were these Imperial Guards purely in a military setting, or would they be close personal protection as well?
I think with both of these Imperial Guards, there would have been that function of protecting the, you know, the royal residence, the imperial headquarters, that kind of stuff. There's no doubt about it. So that's like, you know, the household cavalry and things like that. However, to continue the analogy, the Imperial Guard of Napoleon were his elite fighting force. So then you can start comparing it to more like, you know, the commandos, the SAS. Now, clearly they do very different operations, but the idea is, if you fight the SAS, they're going to be worth 10 of each guy's going to be worth 10 of your average soldiers. And it would have been the same kind of thing with the Imperial Guard. They were the best at reloading. They were the ones who, under exceptional circumstances, they would retreat, but otherwise they wouldn't. They were good shots. You know, they would fight fiercely hand to hand. They were the best that army had.
And just because it suddenly sprung into my mind, and we're running absolutely out of time, and one that I'd like to kind of take this and do a whole episode of this on its own, because it just suddenly occurred to me, which is then the Musketeers. obviously famous, you know, through the Alexander Dumas book, The Three Musketeers. But again, they were a force, and I believe the Musketeers were essentially for the king. They were supposed to swear loyalty completely to the king. And you get this in various different things. Again, America today, you get certain people who, you know, certain police forces and military units that are loyal to the state, and other ones that are loyal directly to the president, you know, whether you're federal or at a state level. And I'd be quite interested in discuss, because the Imperial Guards, obviously, their whole thing is they are supposed to be, in theory, completely loyal to the emperor. That is who they're answerable to.
Yeah.
Were there other units within, especially within Napoleon's army? I think in the Roman army, we kind of get the idea that there was, you know, there was some attempt at democracy still. So there was still bickering and fighting about who could become the next emperor. But in Napoleon's army, were there other units who would be, you know, sworn to France above Napoleon, or was he just the top of the whole army anyway?
Well, you know, that's a tricky situation. You're going to need somebody who's a complete expert in this area. But obviously, in revolutionary France, which in theory Napoleon was still leading up until he crowned himself emperor, people were loyal to the flag, to the idea of égalité, fraternité, and all that kind of stuff. You know, the tricolor flag. He actually, the reason why the Italian flag looks suspiciously like the French flag is because Napoleon imported it and switched the colors around to represent some of the northern states of Italy. So I'm talking my way around this. The simple answer is it's complicated, but certainly the idea of the French army at the time, particularly the early period of Napoleon, was it is here to protect France against all these evil monarchies that we're surrounded by. There was kind of a feeling of paranoia, and that's why they started attacking everybody. And it's just remarkable how much Napoleon was able to do with France on its own, conquering huge tracts of Europe, most of Europe. And yet, obviously, the combined forces of Prussia, Austria, Russia, Spain, you know, all these landlocked countries continental countries, they should have been able to stop France and didn't, which shows you the level of professionalism, training, zealotry even that they had. When Napoleon walked into Italy, his troops were incredibly badly equipped, but you know, he made sure that he invested in the army, and look what it got him.
Okay, well, we're kind of running out of time, because actually, speaking of needing to get someone else on a podcast, once we finish up this recording, we do actually have a special guest who we're going to be recording an episode with. Whether or not, because of the strange way we record and release these, you've already heard that guest or not, I don't know. But
who knows?
Jem, just before we finish up, if I wanted to get a little bit of a breakdown about the Romans, or indeed about Napoleonic Wars, say in 100 facts, is there anywhere I can do either of those things?
Yeah, this is the irony. I've done all this without those books in front of me. But yes, Jem Deducciu has indeed created the Napoleonic Wars in 100 facts, taking you from basically the French Revolution to slightly beyond the Battle of Waterloo. It wasn't actually the last battle in the period. And also there's the Romans in 100 facts, taking you from the foundation to the argument that we've actually had about when did the Roman Empire actually end. So both of those, easily digestible. Both of them mention the Imperial Guards of their various eras. Check them out, and you can do that. You can get them on the Condensed History website, can't you?
You can indeed. If you go to condensedhistories.com/gems, you will find links to all of Jem's books and all one of mine. And if you follow those links through, guess what? We get a little bonus back to help us keep this podcast going. Also, just a quick plug from me. If you can go ahead and check out www.thelastairship.com, my crowdfunding for that will be over by the time this comes out. But we are in filming, so please go and check that out. That's all about a brand new web series that I'll be starting up, currently in the works. That's pretty much all we got time for, because we should be having a call from our special guest in any moment. So I will very quickly say a massive thank you to each and every one of you that's listening, downloading, subscribing, sharing this around, tweeting us, tweeting about the series. Really does. And like Jem says, when Jem has somebody come up to him at an event which has not got anything to do with history, and comes up and says, listening to the podcast, that really does bring us so much joy. Reminds us we're not just talking to each other for this half hour every week. Although, of course, Jem, that would be worth it in itself. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But yes, to other Greg, the Greg who suggested this, hope you enjoyed this. And to my wonderful co-host, Greg, thank you very much.
And thank you very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducciu. And that is all from us for another week. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. And take care.